Well, my name is Gabe McNunn. I am a graduate student at Iowa State University, and I am also fortunately an employee at Ag Solver, which is a small company located in Ames, develops precision agricultural tools. Today I'm going to be presenting some work that I've been doing with Dr. Andy Van Lucke, that handsome gentleman in the back of the room. He's a professor at Iowa State University, and then I've also been working with Dr. David Muth, who is my boss at Ag Solver. So just to give a brief overview of what we're going to be talking about, our focus is looking at subfield variability and trying to identify opportunities where we can reduce our nutrient losses. And so the basic premise behind this is that areas of low yield are more likely to lose nutrients than areas of high yield just from a crop uptake aspect. And so just going through, we're going to talk about in general just nitrogen loss from agricultural systems. We'll briefly touch on that. Then we'll feed into subfield variability in the cropping systems and how that relates to our nitrogen loss. We'll talk over some methods in the framework that we've designed to sort of investigate this relationship between yield, profit, and nitrogen losses. And then we'll also go into how we're using this framework to sort of identify potential areas within fields where we have these opportunities. And so just briefly talk over some issues with nitrogen loss. I think we're all pretty familiar with the hypoxia zone in the Gulf of Mexico, and agricultural lands are feeding that zone through nutrient loss through rivers and streams that feed down into the Gulf. And we're not the only ones working on this issue. This is a big issue. Actually, recently, November 3rd, Tom Vilsack announced that they'd actually be putting $30 million towards 73 projects that sort of improve water quality in the Mississippi River Basin. So working towards reducing these losses. But in general, when we talk about reducing these losses, a lot of times we rely on either farmers adopting these practices voluntarily or relying on some type of incentive, financial incentive through programs, subsidies, or, I guess that's pretty much it. And so basically what we think is that there's actually incentive that exists already at the subfield level so that we don't necessarily, you know, we can try to incentivize farmers to adopt different management practices that will reduce losses. And so to jump into the subfield variability aspects, fields are variable from a variety of different perspectives. We have different topographies, soil types, and basically these lead to variability then in our productivity. And so we can see on the left here, we just have just a satellite image of a field, and just from the satellite image, we can tell that there's variability across the field from the different colorations. But when we look at the actual yield monitor data for a specific year, this variability starts to really pop out. And so we can look at these areas where we actually don't get a lot of productivity. And these are sort of the target areas that where we think, you know, if we don't get a lot of productivity and we're laying down the same amount of nutrients to these areas, these are more likely to be lost in these areas. And one thing to keep in mind here, and actually you can start to see some, just on the bare field, you can see a lot of those spots start to pop out just from your canopy cover. But one thing to realize is that when we're dealing with this yield data, some of these lower yields are actually just an artifact of how the yield data was collected. And so you can see up in the, somebody actually got a laser pointer. In this area of the field right here, you know, these are actually head rows, right? So the farmers come in and they actually use their combine, they'll harvest this and then use this as an area where they turn around then as they make passes across the field. And so basically these low yield values are just an artifact of how the yield was collected. And so there needs to be a balance of how we identify these areas. You know, it's going to take some knowledge of the actual field and then some knowledge of the underlying data. But when we do look at this, we can see that, you know, we do get areas actually in the field that aren't artifacts of how the yield data was collected. And so when we're looking at just one year, you know, year to year, there's a lot of variability, but when we look to when we're looking to identify areas where we want to make management changes, we need to look at variability across multiple years. And so here we've actually taken yield data and averaged it across seven different years. And we can still see now that, you know, some of this is obviously still an artifact of how we're collecting the data up here. But a lot of these areas are consistently low productive areas. And just to go back to the variability in fields, we've overlaid our average yield here onto a DEM layer here just to show. And so originally, part of our thought process was a lot of these areas are probably in prairie potholes, low-lying areas. And so when we graph that, though, you know, in some cases we do get some relationship like that, but in a lot of cases there's really no way of telling where these areas might be. And so we've designed sort of a methodology and framework to sort of test and develop data to sort of prove our theory here. And so to do this, we actually need a lot of data. And so Doug Carlin provided us with 27 different fields and about 10 years of yield data for each one. And so you can see in total we have about 120 years of corn grain yield data, 100 years of soybean yield data. And so for each one of those, you know, we have an individual yield map that we can look at. So part of the problem with our method is that we're sort of restricted. So we have real yield data from all these fields, but the one thing that we don't have is the actual financial background from these fields. And so because of that, we have to rely on crop budgets that are provided from Iowa State. And so these crop budgets are put out on an annual basis. And so we have yield data from 1996 through 2006. And so for each one of those years, depending on what crop is grown in a certain field, we go and grab a specific crop budget for that year to get an idea of how much input investment cost there was. And then we also grab historical grain prices also. And these things help us then to determine the profitability, spatially explicit profitability across the field. And so here is actually the framework that we've designed to sort of test this relationship between yield, profit, and then our nitrogen losses. And so I won't go through this in detail, but just briefly, we take our yield data and we split it through two different pathways here. One pathway is through this PZM, Profit Zone Manager, and this is actually the software that takes our expense data, our grain yield price, and our yield maps, and then converts them and produces a profitability map. And so the yield data will get a profitability map and return on investment map out, and then on the other side, we actually supply some management attributes, daily time step weather for each year, and we put that through the DNDC model. And what that does is that actually we'll run that DNDC model for every single yield point within the yield map. And what that does then is then we get biogeochemistry maps on the other side that basically we can do a point-by-point analysis or comparison with our yield and profit data and then our nitrogen losses. And so just to give sort of an example of what's coming out on the profitability side, these crop budgets actually provide you sort of with three different levels of expense. They have a low, moderate, and high expenses. And so here we run each of the fields at all these different expense levels just to get sort of a general idea of how the expenses shift or can be shifted depending on our grain cost and then our input expenses. And so we can see actually then, you know, at low expense, we can see these white areas is where we're these break-even areas. As we incur more expenses, these start to become bluer and bluer. And so these are actually the areas that we're sort of targeting. These are those really variable areas where, in general, we're probably not going to make a lot of money on. And in fact, in a lot of cases, we're actually losing money every time we allocate resources to those areas. And a different way we can look at it is we can actually start pulling away all the area where we're making money and just focus on those areas where we lose money. And in this case, we've taken 1 year, we've pulled away all the profitable areas, and we've gone back and calculated basically the required productivity increase that we'd need in these areas to reach a break-even level. And so in some cases that can tell you, well, if I'm a bushel short, I'm 2 bushels short, maybe I can get that, maybe I can increase my yields by that much. But in a lot of cases, you know, when we're up towards those 50 bushels, on a year-to-year basis, if you're not getting the productivity in those areas, it's not likely that you will be able to get that through supplying or allocating more and more resources to those areas and sort of trying to chase yield in that way. And so similar to how we handled the yield data, averaging across multiple years, we can start to look at the profitability across multiple years. And sure enough, we do get a lot of variability in our profitability. Again, we can see head rows, so we're not gonna take those into consideration, but we see these areas in here where on a consistent annual basis, we do not make money. And in fact, we start to lose money in those areas. And so these are sort of the target areas where we want to go in and look at those potential savings in nitrogen if we were to pull those out of production altogether and put in some other type of system like a CRP, a perennial, even a bioenergy crop, switchgrass, something that will keep roots in the ground and reduce losses. This is just a brief overview of the year-to-year data that's underlying this field. I won't go through it in detail. The only thing I did want to make note of is that yield doesn't necessarily lead to increased profit, right? So we see it these final years, 2005, we actually averaged 190 bushel across the field, but our profitability is in the red right here. And then in 2006, actually, we drop yield 160 bushel, but our profitability spikes up. And we have similar input costs there. And the story behind that then is actually our grain price, right? And so we can see here then, you know, the impact that these other grain price and input costs have. So when we go back to our average, we can take a look and start identifying these same areas that we did with our yield maps. In a lot of cases, they do align fairly well with where we saw in the yield maps we weren't getting as much productivity as we should. And when we look at the area of these different, the acreage of these different areas, you know, these are some significant areas. You know, so we will build up. We can see here we get close to almost 6 or 7 acres in the field where we really don't have a lot of financial benefit to farming those areas. And so then on the other side of that framework, on the bottom side then, when we spit in these management practices, we get daily weather, the biogeochemistry model will actually go in and evaluate the nitrogen losses at each one of those yield points based on the yield data and then our soil data and our weather data. And so here's the result of that. And so one of the shortcomings of this approach is that, again, we don't have actual soil samples from these specific fields. And so what we're limited to doing is using Sirgo to actually feed our biogeochemistry model. And so when we look at this, we can actually see these dominant Sirgo polygons from the map units in here. And that's because the biogeochemistry model is just so dependent on those soil attribute data that we're feeding it. And so within those polygons, though, we do see some of the variability then that comes from those different yields. And especially, so here's one area that we can see. And we take a look at the same areas where we're not getting a lot of increased profit, and we start to do a point-by-point comparison, we actually start to see a lot of the trends that we would expect. And in this case, you know, as we increase profitability, we see that we lose less and less nitrogen. But this is also dependent on the year, of course. And so in 2005, this was a somewhat dry year. We still get our sort of the slope that we would expect, but the slope is reduced in this case, and a lot of times it's a little bit flatter than before. And that's because, you know, we're looking at leaching in this case, hydrologically driven, and so 2005 was a fairly dry year, so we just don't get as much impact in that year. But we can see that there are still significant losses. And so just a quick recap of everything we've gone over so far. We talked about the negative effects of nutrient loss on the environment. I think we're all fairly well aware of that. We talked about the variability in cropping systems. You know, we have variable topography, we have variable soils, and inherently this leads to variability in yield, which leads to variability in profit. And basically, you know, we're trying to answer this question of how do we better allocate resources at the subfield level to reduce losses to the environment. And then how do we incentivize these changes? And so these changes can either be incentivized by the reduction in the nutrient loss itself, if a farmer is just, you know, wants to help out the environment, or, you know, it can be incentivized by we're raising field averages. As we pull these unproductive areas out of the field and we start to look at the overall field average, we'll start to see a raise in that, and then the same effect is there for profit. As we start yanking, you know, areas of the field where we actually lose money out of the picture, now our overall profitability starts to increase, right? And so next steps, we're working on the model calibration side of things. At this point, we're using a lot of the default parameters within DNDC for corn and soybean crops. And so we'd like to get a little bit more explicit and detailed in that. We would also like to, DNDC actually takes yield in as an input, and it will try to, within the model, match that yield. And so in most cases we see it actually comes fairly close, but when we get to higher yields it struggles to actually keep up, and we'll actually see that the yield actually varies 5 to 10% below what the supplied yield is. And so in that way DNDC is supposed to be calibrated. You know, we run the model, we look at the output yield, and then turn some knobs and we rerun the model. So we're trying to set up an iterative automated process that will actually do that calibration for us. And then we'd also like to, you know, take a look at the leaching values and the nitrogen loss values we're getting out of our model and start to compare those to literature and sort of build a basis for that. After that, we had a lot of data processing ahead. We had the 220 years of data. So we have to push all of that through the system. On top of that, then, we're going to take all of those results. We have a lot of statistical analysis to do. But on the other side, we're also trying to do some validation in the field. And so this year, we actually did put in a field experiment that sort of explores this idea of profitability versus allocating resources. And so this is actually a field located in northern Iowa. We're focusing on just this portion of the farm. And here we've taken our profitability map, and we've actually divided it into three profit zones. And so we take this, we give it some thresholds. So where we're not making money consistently, that's designated by the red. And then there's this yellow sort of expense-limited zone. And these are the zones where, you know, these break-even zones, where some years we will make money, some years we'll lose money. And then we have the blue, which just represents revenue, which we likely make money year on year. And so within these zones, what we did is we wanted to go test, you know, how effective is nitrogen at increasing yield in unproductive areas of the field. And so for each one of these different plots, we went in and put an N-rate trials. And so we can see our different rates over here and how they applied to the different plots within the field. And so, you know, in these red areas, you know, we're basically looking at whether in these unproductive areas that we get year on year, can we actually allocate more resources to these areas and improve yield, or do we not really get any type of response in these areas? And you can see we actually went from a zero application all the way to 125% of what the farmer actually does on a regular basis. In his case, he actually lays down a lot of nitrogen on a regular basis. I think his field average was usually 200 pounds per acre. And so in some cases at 125, you know, we were significantly higher than that. And yeah, I'd just like to acknowledge everyone at Iowa State, Dr. Andy Van Lucke. Katie's also in the back of the room. She's helped out a lot with the field experiment. We got a great group at Ag Solver, Dr. Dave Muth, Dr. Doug McCorkle, and Joshua Coe, who helped me out a lot with the framework development. And I'd also like to give a special thanks to Doug Carlin, who actually provided us with all the underlying data that we're going to be analyzing. Obtaining a lot of this yield, raw yield data is difficult, and a lot of farmers aren't really necessarily willing to share that. And I think that's it. Any questions?
I believe we have time for perhaps one question.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's awesome, actually.
So it's very interesting to look at this application and what you've done, and of course my question in my mind is always how accurate was the soil survey in identifying the areas of non-profitability. Is that a type of interf that from the soil's point of view we can start looking at to see what were the elements that perhaps it wasn't necessarily leaching, natural leaching, maybe it was something else that created that non-profitability zone. And it's just, I ask all those questions in my head as we do the presentation.
So those are the questions that we actually ask ourselves every day. This we are tied to Surgo very heavily, and yeah, we wonder about the accuracy of that. And so we really would like to go take some field samples and start to test, you know, how much does that impact the outcome of the model. The profitability side of things is not dependent on the Surgo data at all. So that's just purely dependent on the actual yield data provided from that field. But on the biogeochemistry side, yeah, you know, I can't, in fields, you know, soil samples would be probably a better route if we wanted to get some more accurate modeling results out of specific to that field.
So we always hope that our soil surveys are better than you think. One of the pieces that we're starting to explore, and in fact I had a poster yesterday up on it, about rasterizing, truly disaggregating our soils data nationwide and working towards a raster bit.
At a smaller resolution than the polygons?
And also, you know, just exploring that aspect and whether that would be a more useful tool to folks like you than the polygon data that you have. I presume, do you use Grid Circo, or do you use, or do you just take the polygon data and...
We take the polygon data basically and intersect that with whatever layer we're trying to analyze. Yep. And so I can attest, so there's two different parts to that. I actually had a conversation last night about this with a professor who runs a biogeochemistry model, and he's actually done comparisons of in-field soil sampling versus the Sergo data, and he actually says that the results you get are really similar. You don't... Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, that's it.